Hello. I'm Earl Fontenelle, and this is Roots of Magic, a series of discussions of the history of magic with members of the research center Magea at the University of Würzburg.
Frank Simons is a junior research fellow at Magea, a PI on the Research Ireland-funded Pathways Project into Mesopotamian Psychiatry, and a man who knows a thing or two about the ancient ritual complex known as Shurpu. Frank, thanks for coming on Roots of Magic.
Thanks very much for having me.
So what is a Shurpu when it's at home? What is the Shurpu or burning ritual? If you could just give the overarching introduction to this corpus.
Yeah, sure. Oh, it's Shurpu is a ritual from somewhere in the first millennium BC, which it's a long and extensive ceremony designed to, if you've been cursed by the gods, but you don't know which god and you don't know why, you perform the ceremony of Shurpu. The curse takes the form of some sort of ailment that we're not quite sure of, something to do with a stomach problem and social isolation, perhaps. There's various things that may have been resolvable by using the Shurpu ritual. And it consists of several different stages in which you first burn, you apologize to the gods, and then you plead with them to let you free of the curse that they've put upon you, and then you burn some things, and then you rub some bread on yourself and throw it in the desert and release a sheep. And hopefully, and at the end, you bring in some demon fighting gods, and hopefully they will solve the last of the problems. And then you wash everything clean and make it all nice.
Okay, so it is extensive. It's a multi-phase ritual procedure. We'll get into each phase as we go along. But let me ask you a kind of multiple question. So this thing survives in ancient cuneiform tablets, mostly fragmentary. We have some larger fragments. We have some smaller fragments. They're found all over the place, right, in the ancient Mesopotamia. We find them from Assur, Nineveh, Nippur, or Uruk, all these places, and more. Sometimes just a tiny bit. So first of all, does that tell us that this is a very widespread practice?
Yes, it definitely is. We have copies, I think, from every major first millennium site where texts are found. We find texts of Shurpu.
Okay.
Strangely, there's not very much reference to Shurpu outside of the texts of Shurpu. There are occasional references to it, but mostly the texts themselves are the ones that preserve the ritual, are the ones that mention, but they're from every major site and from most periods through 1,000 years or so.
Now, first millennium BCE, in terms of cuneiform studies, is actually pretty late, right? Now, this...
Yes,
let's talk about languages a little bit, because this... we've talked about the Sumerians before in this series. And they're the real old boys on the scene.
Yes, right, yes.
Now, this text is bilingual, right? We've got Sumerian vocabulary and Akkadian?
And Akkadian.
So does that mean that there is necessarily some kind of earlier Sumerian analog of the Shurpu ritual, or does it, can we say?
It's a tricky question. There are parts of the text certainly go back a very long way. So the final tablet, the final element of the series is a washing ritual, and that consists of exclusively Sumerian incantations, short Sumerian incantations. And some of those are found in almost unchanged form 1,000 years earlier in the old Babylonian period, around 2000 to 1800 BC. We have copies of those exact spells. And likewise, some of the initial preparation spells, the incantations from the first tablet are found even older. We have one copy is found in a monolingual phonetic Sumerian from a town called Mitaran, which is almost impossible to read without the later duplicates, because it's written in a very strange orthography. As far as the text as a whole goes, the text of Shurpu as a whole, there are some stages of development, but broadly speaking, it seems to have been first brought together into a single coherent ceremony sometime in the late Middle Babylonian period, so roughly 1200, 1100 BC. Okay. At the same time as most of the major texts of Mesopotamia were being brought into a single into the standard form that we know from the first millennium. So Gilgamesh had the same.
Right, the Gilgamesh epic, not the Sumerian Gilgamesh and Enkidu poem, but the
exactly
the full version with all the extra bits added.
Exactly that. They gathered in sometime in the middle Babylonian period, around 1200 BC. The scholars in some part of Babylon gathered together their old texts and started trying to group them into a coherent mass. So they turned the old Sumerian poems into a new epic that could be given a single form. And they did the same with magic quite often. So many of our large magical series come in their earliest coherent single form from somewhere around then. But they survive for around 1,000 years, right up to the very end of cuneiform culture, in fact. So
right.
I think my latest manuscript probably dates to the 1st century BC from Uruk. And
wow.
That's roughly 50 years before cuneiform ceases to be written.
Yeah, and so politically under the Seleucid dynasty.
Exactly, and even slightly later.
This practice has survived Persian hegemony, no problem. Greek hegemony, no, or Macedonian hegemony, no problem. Mm-hmm. It's just a widespread local thing. Now, is one more question on sources. Am I right in thinking that this text as we know it shows this characteristic that is very, very typical of longer magical works, like later on in usually in book form, whereby you can see that at some point and maybe points, compilers have just been taking disparate bits and wanging them together into one big cohesive whole. You see this, for example, with the Sefer HaRazim, the earliest known Jewish grimoire, for lack of a better word, magic book. Is that what's going on here?
It's funny you should mention that. I share an office with a bloke who edited it. he's sitting just behind that wall, actually. It is a similar sort of thing. It's not quite that. They were artful about the way they gathered text together. And so by the time we have Shurpu in the first millennium, in Shurpu, there are several different versions of it. By the time we have the versions we know of from the first millennium, they are individual coherent incantations that are grouped together in a coherent way to make one long ritual that makes sense in and of itself without reference to the earlier material. There was a move at some point to develop Shurpu into a different, for want of a better word, theological direction. There was a Mardukization of Shurpu, where they made the god Marduk suddenly very important in what had previously been a series addressed, broadly speaking, to many gods, or maybe to the fire god specifically. The chief god of Babylon was Marduk, and he became very important in a particular version of Shurpu. And in doing that, they added an extra tablet of incantations in. And in that tablet of incantations, we can see the joins more easily than we can see them anywhere else.
Right.
Usually it's very difficult to see the joins in Mesopotamian text because we have earlier stuff and we have the late stuff. We don't really have the stuff in the middle. The middle Babylonian period is a sort of, there's not many tablets survive, partly due to the nature of the way Babylon has been excavated and due to the flood, the water table in Babylon is unfortunately higher than you'd like it to be to excavate tablets from there. But so the middle period is not very well attested relative to the old period and the late period, which means it's difficult to see the moment when they join together.
Mm.
But in some cases you can. And when you can see the joins, you can see a great deal of poetic skill has gone into making a coherent text.
So before moving on to the poetic side of things, which is really interesting, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the gods involved, because the practitioners of this ritual are living in a world where gods are in charge. And if we expand the focus a little bit, it's not just what we would call gods, but also what we would call frightening non-human entities of various kinds.
Supernatural.
People want to say demons, but demons is a very Christian. It brings a whole, the wrong sense. But scary, potentially vengeful spirits, say.
Yes.
So that's the kind of scene. But what's the sort of... Can you get a little bit more into the specific religiosity of someone who is following the Shurpu ritual in our period, so this like later Babylonian period? What kind of religious life do they have, and what do they believe?
It's difficult for two reasons to answer that. Partly it's we don't really know who did Shurpu, who Shurpu was done for. I assume it was done for an elite class of society because it's a fairly expensive thing. You have to get a fair number of materials together. You need to hire a priest for 2 days, but it may have been performed by almost anybody. It's hard to know. in terms of what they believe, the basic principle of all Mesopotamian magic is that the gods are in charge of everything. So the idea, if you perform a magical spell in Mesopotamia, you're not, with almost no exceptions, you're not hoping to do anything. What you're hoping to do is persuade the gods to do what you want.
Right.
And in the case of Shirpu, the problem essentially is that the gods, your personal god and goddess, who are your protective forces, have become annoyed with you for something you've done. You've done something that's irritated your gods, and they've gone away and left you. And as they've gone away and left you, they've also said, you've done this annoying thing, and you've been marked with a sort of, the supernatural world can tell what you've done.
Right.
And so in Shirpu, you apologize for doing that and hope that the gods come back. And because you've been marked, demons can come and get you. So demons, nasty spirits, horrible things. There's a thing called Mamitu. Mamitu is the main one that Shirpu is against. But there's also Ahazu. Several nasty spirits come from heaven and from the earth and from the underworld and from the water under the earth and attack you. And so a person performing Shirpu believes that they are currently under assault from these nasty spirits because their god has left them. So the aim of Shirpu is to get your god back on side. And you do that through a combination of apologizing to the god and getting the great gods, the big, powerful gods, the gods that are everywhere, to persuade your god and goddess to come back. And when your god and goddess come back, you'll be protected again from the nasty things. And then there's an array of other things you have to do to fight off the nasty things that have attacked you. But
the aim is
to get your god and goddess.
A belt and braces approach.
Exactly that, yes.
But do we think that the attacks of these evil entities take the form of a physical illness? Is someone seeking out Shirpu because they've got a bad stomach ache or something wrong with their body and they're going, oh man, I need to do a Shirpu because I'm sick? Is that the model?
Essentially, yes. We don't know for certain exactly what it is, but Mamitu seems to be, well, there are various views on what it is, but it was probably some sort of a stomach thing, at least in one form. At least one of the symptoms will have been a terrible stomach ache. There's a particular line in Shirpu that's very nice about the roots of Mamitu will not take hold in my stomach. Its branches will not reach up into my this area, the epigastrium area. And that's a sort of a clear poetic way of saying, I've got a stomach ache. Please, if I get rid of you, the Mamitu won't be able to infest my stomach and attack me from within. It seems to probably have had a broader social isolation element as well that we don't quite. It's hard to chase. It's hard to exactly pin down. And probably it wasn't one thing. Certainly in the modern world, we wouldn't consider it one single illness.
Right.
There's quite a lot of work, Mesopotamian medicine at least, is an attempt to give a one-to-one equivalence between an ancient disease and a modern one. And it's very difficult for that to work because there's a cultural element to disease, and there's particularly a cultural element to the way that you identify disease if you identify them not based on symptoms but on causes.
Right.
And if the cause is you've upset the god, then you've upset the god, or you've been bewitched by somebody, or a demon has attacked you out of the blue. They are different diseases to a Mesopotamian person, but they may be the same disease or completely different diseases or 17 different diseases to us, and it's very difficult to know.
Right. So I would love to ask you about the poeticism, the linguistic, because a lot of this ritual is speaking aloud, right? Addressing someone. Right. Well, when you're not burning stuff and doing physical things.
Yes. well, even when you are burning stuff, actually.
You're speaking aloud. So there's this like long and, from what I gather, quite beautiful, sonorous, poetic litany.
Absolutely, yes.
Tell me about that. Tell us about that. Like, can we get into the affective side of hearing this thing? Is it like rhythmic? Is it, how is it poetic?
I hate to keep saying the same answer every time, which is a difficult question to answer. But the fact is that Assyrian Mesopotamian studies has not answered many of these questions yet. We've only existed as a field for maybe 150 years. And for most of that time, almost everybody has been devoted to going, what does that say? Yeah. And working out what it says. and then moving on to the next one. There's a million tablets that we've got to work out what they say. So the questions of how Babylonian poetics work are still to be asked, let alone answered in a lot of cases. There are parts that we can see. As far as magic goes, it's very clearly almost always designed to be poetic. And a big part of the reason for that is that, as I say, the aim is to get the gods to do what you want. And as in any situation, the gods are presumably being assailed constantly by people who are moaning at them and saying, well, can you fix this? Can you fix this? If you can catch their ear, then you can get them to do it more likely. So they make these spells are made poetic, not just because it's nice, but because in making them poetic and fancy, there's a chance that you'll the god is more likely to listen to you because you've done it in a way they'd like to hear. And there's a particular line that I like in Shupu. Well, there's two lines that I like. One in Shupu Tablet 2. Shupu Tablet 2 is a list of the ways in which you, of the things you may have done wrong. And one of the lines, I think very early on in the text, is Anna ulla ikpu, which means he said yes for no, he said no for yes. So essentially he lied. And you could say he lied. Instead of which they say Anna ulla ikpu. And it's these twisty little things that they do, and the doubled consonants in the right places, and the same sounds through several lines, a continuous sense of what's going on. But there's a particularly nice bit in Shupu 4 as well. In Shupu 4, and in Shupu 3, you mentioned a litany. Only two tablets of Shupu actually have a litany per se, where the same line is repeated at the end of every other line. So it's in the way that, I don't know, the Catholic Church, they do the similar sort of, and also with you, and maybe in tablet 4 of Shupu, there is the first 60 lines list ways in which Marduk can help you, or has helped you, or ways in which Marduk is brilliant. And at the end of each clause, they say, Bullu tushullumu Marduk itikkama, which means to pardon and to restore, to make healthy and to keep healthy. They rest with you, Marduk. They are your powers. And the interesting thing about tablet 4 of Shupu is that throughout the other lines, those sounds, the b, l, and sh, which are the three sounds that chiefly make up that phrase, are repeated over and over and over and over again. In every line, there's more of them than would be needed or than can be explained through anything other than they were trying to get those sounds in, because they wanted to resonate with the refrain of the text. So the litany of the text is resonant with most of the lines of the text. There's a particular line, sorry, I'm just trying to find it as I'm talking, about the woman and her fetus. Ah, there we go. Yes, so there's the line reads, Eri tu kadu sha libi sha shulumu, bulutu shulumu marduk itikama, means to keep the pregnant woman together with the fetus inside her healthy. Are your powers, Marduk? You keep healthy and you keep well. And following that is shuludu shumu shurshu bulutu shulumu marduk itikama. And an interesting thing about the line is that the way, not to get too technical, the Akkadian is written partially logographically, so that the line involving the fetus actually reads, in cuneiform script, it reads eritu kadu shashasha shulumu shuludu shumu shurshu, and is then followed by bulutu shulumu. And this is a clear attempt to get lots of sh sounds in a row, because it resonates with the refrain. As soon as the refrain stops in line 60, they stop this altogether and there are no more sh. There are just a normal number of shs, right, and a normal number of buzz.
That's beautiful. And if I'm the listener, not the trained scribe who writes this thing, and not, are we going to call the person doing the ritual a priest? Do we have a name for this? The practitioner?
You could call him the Ashipu, okay, or the Mashmashu. That's the Akkadian word for it, Ashipu.
So the Ashipu presumably knows Sumerian, right? Certainly the scribe who wrote it knows Sumerian anyway, if they're not the same person.
Probably the same person.
Okay. But the client won't necessarily know any Sumerian. So
no, certainly not.
At least half of this is going to be unintelligible. It's going to be like beautiful, sonorous, weighty words, but mysterious, right?
Exactly, yes. And part of the reason for that is, at least there's a suggestion. Daniel Shamer particularly has mentioned it recently, is the gods speak Sumerian.
Right.
And so when you're talking to the gods, you talk Sumerian. And it doesn't matter that nobody can understand you, just as God speaks Latin in the Catholic Church.
Or, exactly. In medieval Western Europe, medieval, when you hear Latin, you know God's involved. Maybe the devil, but usually God. Yeah.
Yes, exactly that, yes. The patient, actually, is an interesting thing, because it's not entirely recited by the Ashipu. The Ashipu recites bits and the patient recites bits. And it specifically says in the what we have is a ritual tablet, a tablet that describes what you do, how you perform Shupu. First you light a fire and then you pour a circle and then you do this and then you say this and then he says this and then you make him say that and then you do other things. We can see that there are certain parts that the patient recites and certain parts that the Ashipu recites, and we know the actions they're performing at the same time. And it's an interesting thing, if you gather together from various magical texts, not just from Shupu, the instructions to recite things, what we can see, there's sort of three quite clear trends. One is that the patient, when the patient is to recite something, is never in Sumerian. It's always Akkadian, the patient has to recite. There are no instances, which makes sense because the patient doesn't know Sumerian, and the Ashipu is supposed to, or at least theoretically does. And the second is that almost always when they recite things, they are very repetitive things. So they recite bits where they say the same three lines a few times in a row. And what is also quite interesting, and that I've only really noticed in the last few months, I'm planning to write a paper about it with a friend of mine, is that incantations weren't necessarily spoken by a single person all the way through even. So that it's quite clear that in some cases, the ashapu will speak a bit, and then the patient will have to say a bit, and he'll just say to the patient, "Now you say this." And certainly in the case of Shupu 2 and 4, this litany element, almost certainly the litany element was recited by the patient and possibly by anyone who was standing around watching, because it's an easy thing. They can just say, and everyone can say that at the end of every sentence, and it makes the whole thing a bit more of a spectacle. Yeah. And, you know, these people had families and friends, and they weren't sitting on their own in a desert. This happened in somebody's house. Shupu is done in your house, and everyone else who lives in the house is presumably around, and it doesn't happen in secret. Or probably it doesn't happen in secret. Nobody's really written very much about this, I think. But I was in Bali a few months ago. I have some friends there, and I came out of the room I was staying in, and somebody was doing Shupu in front of me. It was exactly the same spell. He was pouring salt in a circle. He was rubbing something on his head. He had a bad foot. My friend had a bad foot, and this priest had come and was performing Shupu. But the thing that struck me wasn't so much the magical element of it, the ritual element of it, but the fact that everyone was just sitting around, not really paying any attention.
Right.
His mum was sitting there, onions, and his granddad was sitting there smoking, and then every so often they'd turn around and laugh at the priest, and then they'd just carry on.
When you say a priest, what kind of priest are we talking about?
Hindu priest.
A Hindu guy. Okay.
He was a Hindu, well, the Hindu doctor is what they called him, but what he was is he also did prescribe medicine, but he did both things. He prescribed medicine because I jumped in a river at some point and smashed my neck I hit my head very hard on the bed of the river, and was in agony for about a week. But he was one of the people they called, because it's a very isolated part in a mountain in a jungle somewhere in the middle of Bali, and it's not very easy to get to a hospital. But they said, "Oh, we'll bring you the doctor." And what the doctor turned out to be was a priest who does massages, which was not at all what I wanted, but was what I got.
And did it help?
But that
did he sort your neck out?
No. I got to a hospital when I arrived back in Germany. I got to a hospital the first day, and they did an X-ray, and they said, "Well, it's not broken, but it has been broken," which is more disturbing than anything else, really. I don't remember breaking my neck, but apparently.
I'm glad you
anyway,
did. I'm glad your neck's okay. Now, you have just given us the beginnings of a window into the phenomenology of this this ritual. And that's really the most interesting thing. I mean, all of the stuff we've been talking about is interesting, but let's try to reconstruct. As someone who's deeply familiar with this text in all its variations, you're trying to prepare a really definitive edition / recension of this text right now, or identify the different recensions.
Yes.
Let's cast our minds back 3,000 years to the house of someone who has some kind of what we would call a gastrointestinal complaint, and they're not happy. They're convinced that I must have done something wrong. My gods are pissed off with me. What happens next? Feel free to speculate intelligently, as long as you say that's what you're doing. But let's go through this thing step by step, because you're talking about making a salt circle. I mean, you're talking about a lot of stuff that is still around in magical traditions today, which is one of the
absolutely yes.
So let's go through the Shupu.
There's only two tablets that preserve the ritual organization of the text, and one of them I found last year. The other one was breaks after about half of the ritual, and the next one now has the last half. The last half of all of the lines of the last half of the ritual, which means we can restore quite a lot. But it's
from a more generalist perspective, that in itself is incredibly important and fascinating. If we look at the field of, say, Greco-Roman magic, even Greco-Roman religion, we don't have written testimony to how rituals are done. We know, for example, we know that the Greeks and the Romans both did sacrifices. We don't know what the procedure was. We do not know. No. So to have an actual thing laying out, this is what you do, is unbelievably precious and rare from antique magic across the board, antique religion as well. So that's amazing.
It's surprising, actually, because in Akkadian, it's relatively common. We have really quite good ideas of how they, in fact, in sacrifices and divination as well, we know exactly how they did divination. We know exactly what they looked at first and which bit they looked at and how they held the thing and where each bit says. And we know not only what they did, but what it meant, what they did as well. So we have this vast mass of material that's not really been published very thoroughly yet. But for magic especially, it's not uncommon to have a really quite thorough set of ritual instructions that tell you everything, and that's better preserved than Shupu. Shupu is among the middle preserved ones. It's until recently, it was one of the worst preserved ones because this extra 50% of the text has really increased it. But it is, yeah. It's a very valuable thing. And it starts, the text is 100 lines long, 80 lines, something like that. And it starts with the line, Enuma Nepeshi Shashupu Tepushu Napata Tukan, which is when you perform the rituals of Shupu, you set up a brazier. So you set up a burner, probably a little pot, really, rather than a huge, great thing. But So this is instructions for the Ashipu. So the Ashipu goes to somebody's house. He's been called to somebody's house. He sees they're in bed. They've got this terrible problem. And he goes to their room, and he presumably first he cleans the room and makes it nice. And then he sets up a brazier in the middle of the room, or somewhere in the room. And he places reeds across the top of it to start the fire. Then he surrounds it with a circle of flour, a magic flour circle, while reciting an incantation addressed to that flour circle, which makes it ritually effective. So this is also actually a new part of Shupu in the last few months. The circle is in the spell. It's described as your flower is the brickwork of a temple. May the brickwork of a temple be strong. May its fate be good. And the idea, I think, is that the flower becomes a solid wall that demons and nasty things can't get through to the middle of the circle where the brazier and the priest and possibly the patient are all inside this circle. So nothing nasty can get in. So having poured the flower circle, then the priest recites, the Ashipu recites the spell Ngae Lukuga Me'en, which is a Sumerian incantation. I am a pure man. And essentially it just says, I'm really nice, I'm pure, I'm clean, the gods like me. All the evil things should go away. Get out, my spell will make you go away. And then he sprinkles water around while reciting an incantation about the water and how pure the water is. Then he lights a torch from a flame, a sulfur flame specifically, and fumigates the patient while reciting two different spells, one addressed to the burn at the god of fire, Gira, and one addressed to the sulfur flame itself. They're quite poetic and beautiful in their own way, but maybe I'll come back to that if we have time. All of the incantations up to this point are just in Sumerian. At this point, or Sumerian and Akkadian, in fact, even the bilinguals were almost certainly recited in Sumerian. The Akkadian is probably there just as a sort of quick thing so the priest can tell quickly where he is on the tablet. Because although they could read Sumerian, it's difficult to read Sumerian, and they could read Akkadian quite well. So if they had an Akkadian shorthand, and we can say that for certain because in later tablets, quite often the first line, usually the way they write it is Sumerian, then Akkadian, then Sumerian, then Akkadian. But the first line will be switched around, so the Akkadian is first. So if you just pick up the tablet quickly, you look at the first line, you can see the Akkadian, you go, no, that's not the one I want. Everything up to this point in Sumerian. Then you place the handle of the torch into the patient's hand, and he lights the brazier. And as he lights that, he recites the incantation, I am holding the torch, be gone, evil demons. Ashi gizila putur lemnu, be gone, evil things.
You say he, but could it be a she as well?
It could be a she as well. The reason I say he is because in Akkadian, well, Sumerian has no grammar, no grammatical gender. Right. So it's impossible to say. In Akkadian, there is grammatical gender, and the verb forms are universally for this sort of thing, except universally are masculine. But there's a complication to it, which is that when something is indeterminate or plural, the masculine takes over. So everything is written in the masculine, and we say masculine because that's how the Akkadian has it, but it was almost certainly for anyone, men and women, children. I think it could be for anyone, as far as we know. The Ashipu is more likely to have been male, but we don't know that for certain either. It's possible there were female Ashipus as well. Again, everything is written as though it were a male. But everything's always written like that, so it's difficult to say if it's meaningful or just that's the way they write things. So having lit he lights the brazier, and at this point the ceremony can begin properly. So up to this point, essentially he's purified the room, purified himself, purified the area, and then the brazier is lit. And they can start. How long do you want this bit? Sorry, I realized
this is the best bit. Carry on. Details. This is so cool. I love this. I mean, this is exactly what.
Line 8 of 80, so.
No, this is exactly the kind of thing that a non-specialist will never be able to get their head around. Is like, so tell me, walk me through the ritual, and it's super interesting, right? I mean, I'm just, my mind is popping with all these like parallels to later magical traditions. It's like, what? How is this like 5,000 years later exactly the same? You know what I mean?
It's amazing. What did I say? I walked out of my flat in Bali and somebody was doing it in front of me. Exactly this, without really any difference. I could have been watching, if he'd been talking Akkadian, he'd been doing Sherpa. It's the same thing. Once the brazier is lit and everything is pure and purified and made nice, then the Ashipu recites a very long incantation, Lu Patra Ilu Rabutu, which means let it be released for me, O great gods. And it being the crime I've committed, the thing that I've done to upset you, please let that be. The word they use is pasharu. It's the Akkadian word for release. I think in modern Hebrew, they use the same word in magic to release. something nasty is released from you, it's pasharud from you. So let the nasty thing be released from me, oh great gods. And this is addressed to more or less indiscriminately all the major gods of the pantheon. And it is 200 lines in which the patient, or rather the Ashifu, recites these 200 lines and says, whether I did this or this or this or this, whether it was the sin of the father or the mother, or whether I... There's a nice section where it says he went into his neighbor's house. He put on his neighbor's clothes. He had sex with his neighbor's wife. He killed his neighbor. Whether it was any of those things or all of those things, there's a little story. Whatever it was he did, please let him go. And there is a sort of litany phrase in that, but it's only recited every few lines, so it's not continuous. Lupatra dingirmesh kalmesh. Be it released, great gods, for me. Then the Ashipu recites a second very long incantation, so at Mamitu Kalama, which is means any divine sanction, any Mamitu, any divine sanction or curse that I've been afflicted with, let it go away. And this also has a refrain in it, Upashar Mashmash Dingi Rabuti, I think. May Marduk, the exorcist of the great gods, release it for me. And it lists in a similar way these 200 lines of the things that the patient has afflicting him. So the Mamitu of tree and field and hedge and bush and plough is one line, for instance. And it's written very obliquely, so it's difficult sometimes to work out what that means. But essentially what it means is the sanction I've been afflicted with for anything bad that I did involving a tree, a bush, a field, or a plough. And sometimes it's more explicit and it says the sanction for having ripped up a particular kind of grass when I shouldn't have done, or for doing something particular, but mostly it's just a noun associated with Mamitu, and then you have to hope that it'll get over it. At this point, the patient then scatters flour, pure, like a particular kind of coarse, cheap flour around, which is used throughout magic, Mesopotamian magic, as a sort of purification material. So he scatters this flour around, and then the Ashipu gets some of it and rubs the patient with the flour and then throws it in the fire. And the idea of that is that it absorbs the problem, some of the problems the patient has, and then burns away. You can't burn the problems the patient has because they're divinely inflicted, but the idea is that in rubbing it on the patient and throwing it in the fire, you at the same time as you're doing that, you're reciting the Ashipu recites an incantation, Lizizu Anu Antum Lineu Mutsa, which means may Anu and Antu, the god of heaven and his wife, may they be present, may they keep illness away. And every line of that is another god that you want to be there, and another, and with an explanation of how he's going to help you. So Anu, Antu, Enlil, Enki, Tishpak, Inanna, Marduk, Asaluhi, may they be present, may they do X to stop me being ill again. And I think for each line that you, each time you say that, the Ashipu grabs a handful of flour, rubs it on the patient and chucks it in the fire. And so moves the problems from the patient into the fire, and the gods hopefully do likewise. Then the Ashipu sprinkles water on the patient, so he washes the patient all over with water. I think probably basically to get rid of the flour that's still stuck to him, because the flour now is evil. It absorbed all the problems, and you don't want it stuck to you because it's got all your problems. And also, you're covered in flour. You're covered in flour. Then the Ashipu takes in his hands garlic, dates, palm fiber matting or some sort of rope stuff, some fleece, some goat hair, and some red wool. And he holds it in his hands and holds it either over the patient or onto the patient in some way near the patient, while reciting an incantation, Ashul Galagin, an evil curse like a Galu demon, which is it's an incantation which in Mesopotamian stuff we call it the Marduk Ea dialogue. Magical practice in Mesopotamia is thought of, the reason they do the things they're doing is that in time immemorial, a god did it and it made it work. And you're reenacting the things done by the gods in time your. And in the Marduk Ea dialogues, they consist of a short introduction in which a fairly poetic Sumerian introduction of the problem is, so in this case, a Galu demon came down from heaven and he's smashing the man and he's kicking him on the street and he's making the young woman cry in the street and everything's miserable. And Asaluhi, or Marduk, the god of magic and the chief god of the pantheon in a later period, noticed this. And he went to his father Ea, or Enki in Sumerian. And Enki is the chief god of all magic. He invented most magic. And he says to Ea, or Enki, He repeats the problem that was listed at the start. So this nasty demon has come down, he's killing people, he's making everything horrible. What do I do about it? How do I fix it? And Ea says to him, Ea is Marduk's father, I should have mentioned. He says, my son, you know what I know. Of course you know how to do it. And then he tells him what to do. He says, you do this. And that's the end of the dialogue. And in this case, what he says is, you take garlic and dates and wool and fleece and palm fiber matting and some red wool, and you rub it on the patient and throw it in the fire. And he says that in more or less so many words. And then the dialogue starts. So that is presented as a separate incantation in Sumerian, recited by the Ashifu while holding these materials over the patient or in some way near to the patient to absorb the patient's problems. And then the Ashifu rubs him with those materials, it says specifically, and then places them into the patient's hands, presumably one at a time rather than all at once. Because then the following section of Shirpu is about 100 lines or so, 140 lines, in which the patient recites incantations. The Ashifu presumably tells him what to say, but the patient recites them. And the incantations all take roughly the same form. He peels apart the, so at the same time, he peels apart the garlic. So he gets a clove of garlic, peels it apart, clove by bowl of garlic, so he peels it apart, clove by clove, and chucks it in the fire one at a time. And as he's doing that, he says, just like this garlic, which will never be a salad and will never grow into a garlic plant and be never made into food for the gods and be never made into food for a king, just like this garlic is being burned in the fire, so may my problems, my sins, my curse, my illness, my sickness, my error, my long list of things, so may they be burnt, may they go away, and may they never be restored. But the last few lines, with the exception of the first two lines, which change a bit depending on what he's throwing into the fire, the last five or six lines are identical every time. And so it becomes a sort of litany that the patient can repeat without difficulty while he's throwing things in the fire. So he does this with garlic and then dates. He throws the date, plucks the dates, just like these dates, may they never be made into a meal, may they never be anything nice. Just like this rope, may it never be useful, used for anything useful. Just like this fleece, may it never be made into clothes for god or king. Just like the goat hair, may it never be made into clothes. Just like this red wool may it be destroyed and burned. And he picks it apart and throws it in the fire. Then the patient grabs a handful of seeds and cheap flour and drops it over and over again while he recites another spell, which is called Zera Upunta Mala Upnaya. My hands are full of seeds and Upuntu flour. And the first half of that spell is clearly recited by the patient. And what it is, it says, he picks up a handful of these stuff and he says, my hands are full of seeds and flour. And then he drops it. And then he picks up again, my hands are full of sickness and illness. And then he drops it. Picks up again, my hands are full of leprosy and scabs and drops it, and so on and so on for 10 lines or so, always picking up this thing and dropping it. So the obvious, I mean, it's fairly obvious bit of magic where the patient says, my hands are full of this, and then suddenly they're not anymore. And then they got rid of. And then it's finally he rubs himself with these flowering seeds that he's picked up and dropped over and over again and chucks them in the fire while reciting another one of these exactly similar incantations, just like this flowering seeds may never be made into bread, so may my problems be got rid of. And at this point, the Ashifu comes along and starts reciting things again. He puts out the fire while reciting two incantations. The first one is, it says, I am a Shangamahu priest. I'm an important exorcism priest, and I have kindled a fire. But just like this fire I kindled, may it now be put out and calmed down. And then the second one, be calm, O valiant Gira. Nuh Gira Kuradu. Be calm, O valiant Gira. Gira being the fire god. And he recites that as he puts out the fire. He says, Gira, you're wonderful. You're brilliant. Now calm down, please. Because you've chucked all the stuff in the fire, and now by putting the fire out, you've got rid of the problem, hopefully. And the idea is the fire god will take all these problems away with him as he is extinguished. In one version of Shirpu, another thing comes in here, but I'll avoid muddying the waters with that because because this is the point at which Gira becomes particularly important and they want to Mardokize Shirpu to some degree. Another incantation is brought in at this point involving tying string around a patient and cutting it. But that seems not to be in most of it. That's just in the Marduk version because Marduk is really important in that. Marduk is the one that does the cutting. And it's brought in just at the moment after you've burnt everything, but before you put the fire out. So it's clearly brought in specifically to sort of undercut Gira at the moment that he's important. Anyway, so once the fire is out and the brazier is finished, the priest takes the brazier out through the house, through the front door of the house, and presumably right to the edge of the town and throws it away into the city rubbish dump to get rid of it as far away as possible. And all the way out and all the way back, he has to recite a particular spell, about it's Udukhul Edina Zushe, evil Uduk demon, go to your step. Go back to the step, go back to the desert. And he has to recite that all the way he's gone and all the way he comes back so that nothing follows him back to the house where he's made things clear. When he gets back to the house, he draws another flower circle around the gate to keep up all the nasty things out. Again, presumably while reciting this flower circle incantation to keep all the nasty things out from coming into the house. Then he goes into the house and where he had the brazier, he sprinkles water around to wash it all down. While he's doing that, he recites an incantation about sprinkling water around, which is not very well preserved. Only the first two lines are preserved. Then our tablet breaks a bit, which is annoying because it's at this point, we're not exactly sure what goes on, but this is another Ayah Marduk dialogue. In the incantation tablets, we know what happens next because we know what comes next in the order of the text. In the incantation tablets, it's a second Ayah Marduk dialogue in which Marduk goes to Ayah, he says, there's his problem. And Ayah says lots of things about spitting on some bread and rubbing it on the patient and then taking it out and burying it under a thorn bush. And then various gods of the steppe will help. And after this, the text becomes not quite so clear because it's broken, and because this is a new part of the text that I've only really found in the last, not just of the ritual tablet, but of the incantation texts. This is a whole new tablet, 200 more lines of text that exist that didn't exist in any previous edition of the text. So it's still a bit questionable what's going on, but it's clear that he's reciting a number of incantations. He seems in the first instance to make some figurines of the nasty demons that are attacking Mummitu particularly. And my guess is that he makes this figurine out of clay or dough or something and puts it in a wash basin, a bronze wash basin, and draws another figurine around it in flour. I'm getting this from other rituals where they do the same thing. And then he points his finger at it and recites, "You, Mummitu, you're a terrible, nasty thing, and you must be gone forever, you evil thing." And it's quite a long incantation. And then another incantation of a similar kind. And then he pours water on it and washes the figure away, so destroying the Mummitu. Then there's an incantation, "You grass atasasatu," which is addressed to, well, a particular kind of grass that is used in purification. There's not exact, nobody really knows exactly what it is. Somebody once suggested it was cannabis, but I don't think it's been particularly believed. But you roll a pellet of this grass and you place it on something. I would guess probably on the censer. So maybe it's some sort of aromatic grass. It could be cannabis, I suppose, in which case they're getting high while they're doing this at the end. But they roll a pellet of this stuff and put it on the censer to burn. So they've relit the censer in the meantime. And then he does something involving tamarisk. He puts his hand on top of tamarisk and recites an incantation about the tamarisk. "You tamarisk, you're so great. May you destroy problems." And then again, another similar sort of thing where he puts his hands on top of tamarisk and a thing called mashtakal, which is another kind of grass and or plant of some kind, and a palm heart, and does the same thing. "You're great. Please help me." Then the priest takes the wash basin out through the gate that had the Mummitu figurines in it, probably. He takes it out through the gate and chucks it away again. And when he's on his way back, he recites another incantation to keep out the nasty demons. When he arrives, he draws another flower circle around the house gate or the front door of the house to stop things getting in. And then we're coming towards the end of the thing now, and he recites this long incantation, "Ashi Gamlia, I am holding my curved shepherd's crook. I'm holding it in the air. I'm raising my shepherd's crook. May the nasty things go away." And this takes the form mostly of a long list of gods, essentially lists 10 gods, and then says, "I am raising my shepherd's crook. May the patient be healed. May he be released. May he be restored." And he does that over and over again. If you look at which gods they are, it's probably that they were mostly gods associated with fighting demons. They were gods of the underworld or of the sweet water below the world, the Apsu, it's called in Akkadian, which is where demons live. Or they were warrior gods that fight demons away. Finally, at the very end, you place the Mulilu sprinkler. It's a sort of pine cone type thing. If you look at Mesopotamian reliefs, there's often pictures of a genie holding a little purse and a pine cone. And the purse is a bucket and the pine cone is aspergillum, I think, is the equivalent that you get in dictionaries. But it's a sort of thing, you dip it in the water and sprinkle stuff on like that. You give that to the patient and he sprinkles water all around while the priest speaks some more. And then you do a final washing ritual where you wash the patient's mouth out with tamarisk and mashtakal and salt and incense. And then you wash his hands and then you wash his whole, and then you fumigate him again and you wash his whole body. And then the final line of the ritual tablet says, "The priest prostrates himself and goes straight home without looking back." And then Sherpu is done. So I don't know if you anticipate that taking 3/4 hour, but I'm afraid it did.
Well, I think the ritual itself probably took
a full day, I think.
By the sound of it, yeah, a long time. That is a serious... Well, look, there's so many interesting parallels in that ritual with every form of magic that one comes across. You've got historioli, you've got implements, the shepherd's crook, you've got a wand, right? Yeah, you've got a practitioner's wand. You've got circles, magical circles, protective, and you've got repetition, which is something that seems to especially occur in exorcism from my, at least anecdotally, like you do it, then you do it again to make sure it worked. You do it again to make sure it worked. That, you know, like you get this a lot in exorcism traditions. And I don't just mean in the movie The Exorcist, even though that is an amazing movie, but it's this kind of like keep doing it until it works approach.
Exactly, yeah. Go again and again and again.
Fascinating.
Yeah, well, I think that's certainly the big picture.
Brilliant. Frank Simons, I feel like, you know, our listeners, not only have they learned a lot about this very ancient, very widespread magical religious practice from Mesopotamia, but they've also probably had all their negative vibes purged just by hearing you go through this ritual.
Minute detail, I'm afraid.
Yeah. And keep up the good work. I can't wait for your edition to come out. So people can have a look at it. Is that going to be addition of the cuneiform with weather-facing English translation styling?
It's going to be a full critical edition. So it should have a party tour. So I'm not doing copies of the tablets because that takes forever, and I'm not very good at it. But we'll have a party tour transliteration. So that means a score transliteration, essentially every manuscript of every part of the text, line by line. So for each line of text, each manuscript written one after the other, followed with an eclectic text in normalized Akkadian and a facing English or Sumerian, a facing English translation, and then a very long commentary explaining what I think is going on and a big introduction about what I think the whole series is about.
Brilliant. We look forward to that, and we'll, of course, link to it when it comes out. Frank Simons, thanks for coming on Roots of Magic, and stay magical.
Thank you very much. It was great.